Hello there. I'm that voice in your head alerting you of a disease risk. I'm clearly Michelle Cortens. But before we get into today's infectious episode, I'd like to tell you about a new decision support tool from Perennia. It's called Orchard Tools, and you can find it on the Apple App Store. Use it to support fruitlet thinning and harvest decisions. Now, today's episode is not for the faint-hearted. We're talking about hordes of mummies lurking in orchards, tissues colonized by fuzzy fungi and oozing bacteria, and ultimately rotting fruit and diseased trees. So let's curb their spread. But first, I know you're out there listening, so please colonize the podcast page with your ratings, subscriptions, and reviews. Then stay until the end of the episode for a fun fact. Okay, tree fruit diseases. So many of them. And usually I try to keep these episodes focused. So when I reached out to our guest, I said, how about some fungal diseases? No big deal, right? Then I snuck in some bacterial diseases too, because I couldn't help it. She's a tree fruit pathologist. So joining us to explain the organisms that plague orchards is Dr. Carrie Peter.
Hi, Carrie.
Hello. How you doing, Michelle?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Good. So you're an associate research professor of tree fruit pathology, and on your webpage, you say that you'll help with a burning question about tree fruit diseases. So I bet you get a lot of those.
I do, yeah, and I've actually made the decision to give my cell phone out to people, so I get lots of text messages as well.
And what kind of work do you do?
I do primarily applied work. So I field test a lot of products from chemical companies, both alternative and conventional, new modes of action, new products that haven't been registered yet to see how they work under Pennsylvania conditions. I also, I have a grad student that is studying bitter rot and trying to decipher the epidemiology of bitter rot for our area, and it turns out there's still a lot that we don't know. I have another grad student that is working on post-harvest diseases of apples, and in Pennsylvania, we have the largest pack house in the East Coast, so post-harvest diseases is quite critical for a lot of folks in the area. I work a lot with fire blight, trying to figure out how best to manage that very annoying pesky disease. And another part of my work, research-wise, is we have a weird apple decline problem that has been occurring over the last many years, predominantly on M9 rootstocks that I've been trying to whittle away at understanding. So that's my research program. And then the other half of my program is grower education, extension. So I do a lot of meetings every year. I write a lot for various publications for Penn State. You know, it's every day is different for me.
And where are you based out of?
So I am located at the Fruit Research and Extension Center in Biglerville, Pennsylvania. And so that is south central Pennsylvania. We're approximately 2.5 hour drive from Penn State's main campus in University Park. The county that we are located in is where 75% of the tree fruit in Pennsylvania are grown. So that is why our research station exists. And we've been around for 100 years as of 2018.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
And we haven't met yet, but I hope to visit your area sometime.
Oh, you're always welcome. Yeah.
After the pandemic.
Yes.
Yeah. With all these travel restrictions.
Yeah.
So let's take a minute now to talk about your path to pathology. And why did you decide that fuzzy trees and rotten fruit were for you?
That's a very good question. And, you know, my path hasn't been a straight one. When I was in undergrad, I studied insects, and I studied actually insect viruses. So an alternative, I've always been intrigued in alternative forms of management, pest management. But I went to graduate school for plant pathology, and I studied insect transmitted plant viruses for about 10 years. And I did my PhD in it, and I specifically worked on potato leaf roll virus, which is transmitted by an aphid. And then I did a postdoc where I studied it a bit more on the insect side of plant virus transmission. And, you know, I was feeling a little restless, and I didn't really want to spend a career in plant viruses. I felt I wanted to broaden my plant pathology background. So I found a postdoc at the USD ARS in Beltsville, Maryland, working on post-harvest fungal diseases of apples and pears. And I thought, wow, fungi. I was like, never dabbled in fungi before, and you can see them. And so that job had introduced me not only to the world of tree fruit, but also to the tree fruit production in Pennsylvania. And so had very good connections with growers and the packers in Pennsylvania. And my job, my current job, when it came open, it just seemed a logical fit to go for it. I had never really thought about a career in academia. What really pulled me in was the extension aspect of it. And well, they took a chance and 7 years later, here I am. So my words of wisdom to anyone is that, you know, if you feel like taking a left turn on your path, don't feel bad for doing it, because you never know where it may take you. And I'm very grateful for the folks at Beltsville for taking a chance on me, because it just opened up a whole new world for me.
And lucky for me and our listeners, yeah. You're here now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so the first disease on my mind is powdery mildew. And I just want to know, where is it hiding and when does it cause leaf infections?
So powdery mildew, this is one of these diseases that tends to sneak up on us. It's often called a dry weather disease because it likes dry weather. It likes high humidity, but it doesn't like the standing water like apple scab does. It lurks in the buds. It overwinters season to season in the buds, and it overwinters as mycelia of the fungus. So that's like the growing, as I always call it, the growing legs of the fungus. And then at tight cluster, that's when the spores actually start growing and germinating, and they will start releasing more spores and infecting plant parts and other buds. And so you will often see at the tight cluster stage, you will often see aborted blossoms that are infected, shoot tips that are infected. And so see, shoot tips or blossoms, those are all originating as the primary infection of powdery mildew. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to control this disease culturally, because you can cut off shoots in the winter, but you aren't going to be able to cut out the buds that you don't know are infected. Unfortunately, during the season, the tree is susceptible until the shoots are growing. And so that's till about, you know, early July, until terminal bud set. And so you have to be pretty aggressive early on from tight cluster onward in order to protect blooms, in order to protect fruit, because powdery mildew can go everywhere.
And it's been a concern for us, especially because of the number of new plantings that we have and some on-farm nurseries being planted too. So, and we know it's a good cultural practice to prune out those infected shoots, but do they need to be removed on young plantings? Because it does sacrifice some of that growth.
Right. So from what I've read, it does help if there are like a few, if you see early in the season, a few infections. If you cut them out, that will limit sort of the repopulation of new buds. But the best thing are fungicides in order to prevent that infection and protect infection of green tissue, but also new buds, because the buds is where everything's going to be lurking. And the time frame, as I mentioned, is like the tight cluster stage early in the season. So it starts early with powdery mildew, and being very mindful of temperature. It seems temperature is very important. Temperature, the ideal temperature range seems to be from about 50 to 70 degrees, or in Celsius, it's 10 to 25 degrees Celsius.
Thank you.
And also the ideal seems to be 19 to 22 degrees Celsius, or 66 to 71 degrees Celsius.
Quick correction. She meant Fahrenheit.
But the temperature seems to be more important than the humidity. So especially in the early season, when we can have cool weather where it doesn't feel like it, where it's dry and it doesn't feel like apple scab weather, this is when it seems powdery mildew likes it the best. So being really mindful of those early season cooler weather, and when it's not raining, this is when you would definitely want protection, some kind of fungicide. And sulfur is a cheap fungicide to control powdery mildew early in the season. But cutting them out will definitely help with regards to those early infections.
Okay. And then we start to see the fungus, if it's caused an infection, it starts to get white and ugly. Mm-hmm. Does that fungus still remain active on the new tissue? Like, can it cause an infection from there?
It can actually, because then it can cause secondary infection to growing, like the, you know, new shoot leaves. And sometimes what I've noticed when I've been rating field trials is that I may not see a lot of primary powdery mildew that has emerged from shoots or blossoms, but I'll notice it secondary, like on leaves. And so, you know, the spores will fly, you know, on wind currents and go attach itself to young tissue. So there are viable spores there. It seems that once it gets very hot, like with most diseases, if it gets to be above, I think, 30 degrees Celsius, it shuts the powdery mildew down, and powdery mildew doesn't like those really warm temps.
Okay. And is there a reason why fungicides aren't curative after those infections start to show up?
That's a good question, because I had done a little bit of digging to sort of try to understand that. And it seems that with a lot of these fungicides, they prevent germination. They will prevent conidial germination. So all fungicides aren't created equal with regards to as far as being able to burn out. And, you know, that I'm not 100% certain of, to be honest, as far as why we don't see a curative effect with powdery mildew. And it may be based on the modes of action of some of these fungicides and how they interact with the fungus.
Okay, that's interesting. So if we can move on from powdery mildew, next I want to talk about a slew of summer rots. And we deal here in Nova Scotia, we have black rot, some bitter rot, some calyx end rot, and moderate amounts of dry end rot. So what do they each look like?
Wow. So bitter rot is a rot that later in the infection, you will see spores on the surface and gelatinous spores, especially if it's rainy or humidity. Oftentimes they're orangish, they may be blackish, and they'll be in the shape of a concentric ring. And to know if it's really, really is bitter rot, you would cut through the lesion, like on the horizontal, and the lesion will be in the shape of a V in the flesh. So you'll see sort of this conical shape, and the point will go down to the core. So that is two diagnostic characteristics of bitter rot. As far as like white rot or black rot, I'm not sure if you said white rot. That was on my mind.
Not white rot.
Okay. So, yeah. But even black rot. So black rot, for instance, it would differ in a few ways. Black rot, I tend to see that primarily on the calyx end of the fruit. But in contrast to bitter rot, when you would cut through the lesion, you wouldn't see that B. So that's another distinct characteristics between like bitter rot and other rots, in that the sense that they don't have that characteristic V. It'll be more like round shape into the flesh.
Okay.
And then there was black rot was the other one, calyx.
Calyx end rot and dry end rot.
Yeah. So those ones I'm not as familiar with. And I know that I think because they are at the calyx end, it's going to be, I'm assuming, around bloom time with those diseases. And they are really challenging to control. At least the few times I've seen it here in Pennsylvania, it sneaks up on us. And it seems that there's hot pockets of those diseases. There's susceptibility in cultivars based on like how open that area, the sinus cavities, because I know some of those rots can go into the core. You can have moldy core or core rot as a result of that. So
right. Okay. I've seen the bitter rot before, I know, especially after you described the orange gelatinous droplets.
It's very distinct. Yeah.
And I could see the V-shaped rot as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's neat. And how do these rots differ when it comes to infection?
They differ. So these rots differ infection by how they actually penetrate the tissue. In the sense of black rot, the fungal organism that caused black rot, it finds a natural opening, like a lentisol or a crack or a stomata. And so that's how it'll make its way into the plant tissue. The bitter rot fungal organism directly penetrates. It doesn't need a natural opening. It's pretty tough in the sense it'll just kind of poke a hole through the skin and make its way in. But for many of these, especially bitter rot, which is the one I know the most about, there is a latent phase of the fungus. And so they will penetrate the tissue and then not show symptoms right away. They'll just kind of hang out there. And that's what makes management very, very difficult for many of the rots, is this latent period, because you don't know that a fungal rot spore has caused infection and it's just hanging out there. When a fungus causes infection and it's latent, there's nothing you can do. There's not a fungicide that's going to go in and kill it because it's not actively growing, because a lot of these fungicides target things that are growing and in order to snuff them out. So you don't know there's a problem until it's too late and you see rots occurring. You're like, wait a minute, I sprayed. Why is this showing up? Well, chances are the infection took place, you know, a couple weeks ago, a couple months ago. So that's what makes these rots really challenging.
And what kind of factors affect the success of a summer rot management?
It depends on what the fungus is. I will tell you that right away. And again, to show you the complexity of rot management, I'm going to use bitter rot as my example, since that's the one I know the most about, since my grad student is the expert in Pennsylvania right now on it. What we have found out with bitter rot is that there are many species that are causing bitter rot to occur in apple orchards. So the name of the genus is Colitotrichum. And back in the day, we thought it was just one species, Colitotrichum acutatum, Colitotrichum leosporoides. Well, because scientists and taxonomists and the way they work, they realize there's actually many species and there's species complexes. And so what we found out just in Pennsylvania that, you know, we've pulled out about 10 different species. And what makes management challenging is that not all fungicides work against all these species. Oh. And so the most predominant species that we have found in Pennsylvania is susceptible only to very few fungicides.
Oh my goodness.
And fortunately, the broad spectrums work. Captan, Manka, Zeb, they work. But your single mode of action fungicides, they're few and far between. And there's some other species that have just natural resistance to certain modes of action, which is just how the species is. It's just how it is. And so unfortunately, like if you spray a fungicide and you don't really know what your population is, bitter rot shows up and you're thinking, why am I getting bitter rot when I've sprayed all these expensive fungicides and I'm still getting it? Well, chances are that you sprayed the wrong fungicide that could have controlled the fungus that's there. The other rots, like black rot in particular, that's pretty much one dominant species. The Diplodia is now, I think, this genus, Diplodia seriata, I think is the name. Maybe, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. Used to be Botrysphaeria obtusa, but it's pretty much one species of fungus that's wreaking the havoc. I don't know as far as the extent of fungicide resistance. I haven't done many studies on it, but I imagine it may not be as complicated as bitter rot based on the high diversity of bitter rot species that are out there. What we have noticed primarily with black rot is that when we see black rot, it's the same species coming over and over again. That's not the case for bitter rot. So what we've learned in the last few years, particularly with bitter rot, is that it's important to know what is in your orchard, because that's going to very much affect the available fungicides you can use that are going to be effective to control it. And as far as like calyx end rot and dry end rot, I know that there's a few species. I know Botrytis cinerea, I think, is one of them that causes calyx end rot. That one, there's typically just one species of Botrytis, but Botrytis has the ability to develop fungicide resistance very easily. So you have to be very careful with the fungicides that you use. And it's also, if you're seeing a lot of it, it's important to understand, well, what is going on with that fungus? Am I spraying the wrong fungicides? Does it have fungicide resistance? Is that why it's popping up? So rots tend to be not as straightforward as one has hoped. And it ends up being a little more challenging to have an effective rot management program. And the last thing I'll just mention is that, and I mentioned this earlier, is that in the case of fruit rots, you need to have the fungicide on before that spore hits the fruit in many of these cases in order for it to be very effective.
Okay, good to know. Thank you. I learned a lot there. So if we could switch over to bacterial diseases now. One time I was emailing you about the crown gall disease mm-hmm. that was on the roots of a young planting. Mm-hmm. So can you describe what that disease looks like and how the bacteria cause infection?
So crown gall is another one of these bacterial diseases that tends to sneak up on folks. And so crown gall, it looks like a tumor, essentially. It looks like an amorphous tumor that's on the outside of the plant tissue. And in the case of apple trees or grapes or other other plants that are susceptible to crown gall, you mostly see it at the crown, at the soil line. However, what I've noticed in the last several years is that it's actually on the rootstocks, and that's where I first see it. And I rarely ever see it at the crown, if ever. It's always in the lower half of the tree, which unfortunately makes management a lot trickier. And the galls can grow, and they can really limit the productivity of a tree as far as slowly choking it off. Crown gall can't kill a tree, but it can really slow it down. And as far as being able to identify it, you'll see it can be on root hairs, it can be on the root stocks, it can be on major lateral roots, but it just looks like small tumor growths. And sometimes you have to remove like the dirt. Say if you're planting new trees, really washing the dirt off those roots to see that, because sometimes they'll be hiding, or they won't be very big. And so any kind of dirt that's left over from when they were dug up in the nursery, you know, they might be hiding those galls.
So the best time to monitor would be before planting?
Yeah, it would be before planting. And so the bacteria enters through wounds, and the bacteria is living in the soil. So unfortunately, wherever the trees are coming from, there is a population of Agrobacterium that's getting into the soil. And there's a lot of manipulation with regards to planting trees and digging them up, and lots of opportunities for wounds to be created and for the bacteria to get in there. But I recommend to all growers that they really inspect their roots of their new trees before they plant them, because that's the only time you're going to find out what's going on. And I have in some cases where growers have planted trees and they didn't realize they had crown gall. And I only discovered it when I dug up a bunch of trees. And there is a way to salvage the situation. So it's, you don't have to, you know, ideally you want to remove everything because you are now establishing a population of Agrobacterium in your soil, but that is not feasible if you have 10,000 trees in the ground. So what I've noticed is that areas where growers have really have fertilized their trees, probably more so in that first year than would be normal, it produces a lot of root mass, and it seems to compensate for any restrictions on the root stock or in the roots, and the tree is able to recover. Unfortunately, that's after the fact. The first line of a defense is a good offense. So, you know, you want to make sure that you don't have any galls on those roots to begin with.
And a common question I get is, can you just snap the gall off the tree?
But yeah, you can, but just be mindful of the fact that, you know, you want to make sure that wound is protected, because, you know, there's probably cells hanging out, and it's not going to stop the situation.
Yeah, and it'll continue to produce tumors, right? Because
yes,
it's already infected, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. And you know, I've had trees that have been, I think, like 10, 15 years old, and they died all of a sudden, and I dug them up. I was like, oh my goodness. I said, this is loaded with crown gall, you know? So, you know, and it can shorten the lifespan. It won't kill it outright, but something you need to be mindful of in the event you do have it.
Okay. And since we're already talking about bacterial diseases, your research program also focuses on fire blight, like you said. And that's always a popular topic here in Nova Scotia. So I feel like I'd be missing an opportunity if I didn't ask you a few questions.
Sure, sure.
So how far can fire blight bacteria travel from infected trees?
That's an excellent question. So first, what we do know is that pollinators can move the bacteria around quite well during bloom time. So, you know, the bacteria overwinters in the previous year's infection at that living tissue that's bordering the dead tissue, and you get oozing, and the, you know, ooze attracts insects. It picks up that bacteria, and, you know, the insects pick it up, they go to blossoms and deposit it. So you can have, it can move far as far as just by those little vectors. If you have an infected tree and it's oozing, based on wind currents, it can move far. And I know this firsthand because I have single-handedly infected many of my trees because they were on the wrong side of one of my fire blight plantings. So with prevailing winds, they can be spread quite well, especially with oozing. You know, I know they can be picked up on wind currents. You know, I think that would be a really neat project, would be sort of to look at the air biome, to really understand, you know, during the summer and during bloom time, what is the level of Erwinia in the air? You know, we don't really know. I know they can be picked up on air currents because I believe, you know, when there was some tropical storm several years ago, it had really impacted your area quite well, and they blamed it on us. And so, you know, they picked up the bacteria from the Mid-Atlantic and it kind of spewed it. And it wouldn't surprise me for it to be able to move that, you know, far in wind currents. But it can be, I think we underestimate the ability of it to move through wind currents and on insects.
Okay. That's why we try to be really proactive during bloom when we know we have an infection coming up.
Right. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And what does prohexidiome calcium do? Is there a role for it in young high-density trees?
So prohexidiome calcium is a plant growth regulator that controls shoot growth in trees. And years ago, I'm not even sure how long, probably about 20 years ago, they found that it's a very good tool to limit fire blight disease because it hardens off the shoots. And when you're limiting the growth. So when it hardens off the shoots, the bacteria can't penetrate the plant tissue as well. Knowing this, and it seems to be the surefire way of limiting shoot blight in apple trees, we looked at really low rates of prohexidione calcium with the idea of, can we put on very low rates to basically limit fire blight infection while still getting growth? Because young trees, you don't want to suppress growth in young trees. It's all about, you know, reaching the top wire of the trellis as soon as possible and filling out the tree space. You don't want to do anything that will stunt the trees in any way that's going to limit that progress. And what we have found is you can go as low as 2 ounces and still significantly reduce by 40% growth in a season of young trees and dwarf trees. There is some research out there that have said, well, you can put on a lot and can shut the growth down early in the season. The tree will grow out of it and recoup that growth later in the season. But my concern is that when you have actively growing shoots, those actively growing shoots are going to be susceptible to a fire blight. So it's going to have to be an individual's decision during a bad year. Do I want to suppress growth or do I want to control fire blight and not lose trees? I do believe there is a role, and I think we're still trying to tease out the rates on young trees. I typically recommend 2 ounces for growers to put on their trees, especially during years I know it's going to be a tough year where it's warm during bloom. The bloom's been pushed to early May for us, which always coincides with warm weather. It gives the trees a bit of extra protection in the event something could be lurking about.
And my last question is related to the future of disease management. I'm just wondering, are you seeing more interest in biological fungicides? And if you are, what are the benefits and the drawbacks?
Yes, absolutely, with biological fungicides. I work a lot with them every year. The benefits are, you know, it's a resistance management tool. It definitely offers a sustainable aspect to disease management as far as a marketing perspective. Being able to sell your produce saying, you know, I've limited conventional fungicides and you know, on my product. The drawback is they don't all work in every single region. And they really need to be studied for the area in question. So what works in Nova Scotia won't all necessarily work in Pennsylvania and won't necessarily work on the West Coast. So that's the challenge of these products. It's exciting of all these different plant-based, yeast-based, essential oils, bacterial-based products that are out there. But you really need to study them for how they fit with where you're located. So in the case in Pennsylvania, we really straddle sort of the northeast conditions and the southern conditions. We are the battleground here. And we don't have the extreme of the south, but we don't have really the flexibility of the northern climate either. And so what I've noticed is that for us, softer products, these biological products worked best when you have cultivars that have some resistance already a part of the variety, and when the disease pressure isn't extreme. So that often means early in the season when they work best. So for instance, in the case of fire blight, streptomycin is the go-to product of choice in the United States and Pennsylvania. But to limit the amount of antibiotics we put out into the environment, I have, through repeated experiments, have found that using a bacterial-based product like Serenade can be used early in the bloom time to be able to manage fire blight. So you don't have to put on streptomycin early in the season. You can get away with a softer product. So you're limiting the amounts, but it's taken many years to figure that out. And it's trial and error. And I think there's a lot of promise, but the one thing that folks need to remember is that when you read about research in one area, be mindful of where that research is coming from. And also think, will this work for our area? And you probably have to do some, your own on-farm research to determine if it works for you under your conditions. Because that is the real significant challenge of these softer products, is that there are nuances to them. And it takes a long time to figure out those nuances to see where they best fit in your program.
Yeah, and they seem to have more restrictions about the best application conditions. Like some of them don't like sunlight. Is that right?
Right, yes. Yeah. And like, for instance, in the case of fire blight, there's a yeast-based product out there that does actually a pretty decent job, but it's very picky with what fungicides you can mix it with because it's a living product and it's sensitive. It's a yeast. It's going to be killed off by certain fungicides. Even something like sulfur, you can't mix it with sulfur. So you have to be careful and with the nuances of when it works best.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. I had a good time.
Great, me too.
Follow me on Twitter at NSTreeFruit and follow Perennia on Facebook and Twitter at NSPerennia. Thanks to Perennia for this episode where you get infectious information. Thank you to Patty Ryan for splashing the episode onto our website, and to Rachel Brown for recognizing the symptoms of a good episode. And of course, thanks to growers who are fun guys and girls. So here's a fun fact. I think photography and extension go hand in hand. I've already taken 3,300 photos in the last 3 years. The macro lens is my favorite. Bye. Thanks for listening.